I want to pick up on that notion that fear isn't a thing, that essentially it's a way of describing the absence of love. Because I remember somebody telling me in color that black's not a color,
yeah,
which I never knew. It's just a way of describing the absence of color.
Yeah, that's exactly how I see fear. You see, when I was on the other side of the veil, and I said to you I was enveloped in this feeling of love, and the fear was completely gone, it was in that state that I realized that fear in itself is not a thing. It's not a substance. It's actually not even an emotion in and of itself. It is the absence of love. And I had spent my life fighting fear by thinking I have to figure out a way to get rid of fear. But you can't get rid of fear with the very thoughts that are creating the fear. Because what then happens is you start fearing the fear. It was only when I was in the other realm that I realized the fear was gone because there was love. And just like to get rid of darkness, you don't fight the darkness, yeah. You turn on the light. Once you turn on the light, the darkness is gone. You don't know where it's gone, but it doesn't exist. That's what happened. And so now I know that when I'm feeling fear, it is an absence of love. And so every time I feel fear, to me, it means I am being called to love more, love myself more. Like, where am I not loving myself? What can I do to love myself more? What more do I need to accept? So it starts off like really loving yourself means even accepting that fear and not denying it, because the more you deny it or push it, the more it pushes back. But by accepting the fear, you are taking the first step to bring love to the fear, and that's the first step of love. And the more you increase love, the more there's no room for fear. So in other words, you don't get rid of fear, you transcend fear with love, by flooding it with love. And to me, loving myself means letting go, releasing. The most loving thing I can do for myself is letting go of control. It's trusting. That's what loving myself means to me. It also means being open and accepting to receiving the gifts the universe has for me. People that don't love themselves are terrible at receiving. So once you increase love, like you ask yourself, where can I love myself more? Which means, where can I let go more? Where can I receive more? Once you allow all this, the fear dissipates. You don't have to work at getting rid of the fear. And that's why it's so much easier than people think.
Well, and I think that's the trap is in the language, because you don't have to work at letting go of the fear which doesn't exist. Right? So it's like if you think it all the way through, that makes perfect sense.
That makes perfect sense.
You know, it's like, what are we going to do about the imaginary dragons? Nothing. They're imaginary. Right?
Yes, fear doesn't exist. Right. Yes. Yeah. And once you realize that fear doesn't exist, you've put light on it. You've switched the light on.
Yeah.
And yeah, when you realize fear doesn't exist is when you realize I am love.
Yeah. And fear doesn't exist sounds radical and extreme, but actually it's there's old stories about it, but we've all had versions of it where you see something on the ground that you think, oh God, it's a snake. And then you like wake up a little bit more and you're like, oh God, that's the sash from my robe on the floor. Or something like that. And it's like, it was never a snake. You didn't overcome your fear of snakes. You just woke up to the fact that it was a sash.
Yes, exactly.
Right? Or little kids have it with shadows, right? There's a scary monster, and then you look, and it's just the way the moon's hitting the window.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, what are we going to do about the monster? Well, not really a lot we have to do, because when the light shifts, it's not going to look like a monster anymore.
Yeah.
And there's a real kind of ease in that. I don't have to become tougher. I don't have to become a brave little warrior. I can just see more clearly.
That's it. You can see it for what it is.
Yeah. On love and fear. Discuss. When you were speaking, there was a cleanness to the way it sounds like it looks to you, that it's either coming from love or it's coming from fear. Like, that's it.
At what point did it become that clean, if it is that clean for you?
Probably when I'm speaking, it may sound more clean than it really is.
Right.
Because that is the premise from which I start my own internal dialogue, if I have one, is am I reacting from a place of love or from a place of fear? But where the lines start to get blurry is when I am being called to do something for somebody I love, but it's something that I really don't want to do, or it's something that's going to be, it's going to take a huge chunk of my time, my life, my energy, but I love the person I'm doing it for. That's when the lines become a little blurry.
Right.
Is like, if I love myself, I would say no, but then I love that person.
Right.
And the person that comes to mind as I even say that this is my mom.
Right.
It's my mom, and she's getting older, and I love her. I love her dearly. She's been an amazing mother to me. But a lot of her needs and her requirements requires me to do less of what I do, which I love to do, but go and serve her. And so I have, because of my love for her and because of my love for myself, I have had to create a way of doing this where I can be there for her, but also find the richness and the depth in what I'm doing with her so that it's meaningful for me as well.
And so, where does, like, when I hear that, what occurs to me is the way I would know if it wasn't obvious, because sometimes it would be obvious, would be resentment.
Mm-hmm.
That if I was starting to feel resentful, yes, chances are I got that balance a little bit wrong.
Yes, exactly right. Resentment, when you start to feel it's like an obligation. So when it starts to feel like an obligation, when you start to feel resentful of that person, you're better off not doing it, because what you're really doing is, if you're doing something out of resentment, basically you're being dishonest to that person. You are sharing your resentment with them, not your service. Service has to be from love. If it's from obligation and resentment, think in terms of that is the energy I'm feeding them. I'm feeding them my resentment, not my love. And imagine if people performed service for you, family members, close friends, and imagine if one day you found out that they were doing it out of resentment or obligation, how awful that would feel. You would have rather that they were honest and said, you know, I just can't do it. There are nice ways of saying they just can't do it. You would have rather they did that than to do it for you out of resentment. So I always tell people, don't do it if it's coming out of resentment. But if you love the person, find a way to do it where it doesn't feel resentful, where it's rich and rewarding for you, because the person receiving it feels your energy. Mm. We underestimate the energy we feel from each other. And that's another thing that I have an issue with the way that we're conditioned and brought up, where it really is conditioned in us that we are separate beings, we're separate individuals, and that what you see, our physical body, is where we begin and where we end. That's not actually true. Energetically, we all overlap. And when you are speaking to someone, when you and I were here in this room with all these beautiful people, and we're all speaking and conversing, we're not just exchanging words, we're exchanging energy. We could be sitting here and not saying a word, and we would still be transferring energy.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is, the reason why I say it's so important to love yourself, because when you love yourself, you don't even have to say anything. Your very presence is all that's needed to heal a situation. And so if I'm going to serve my mom, I make sure that I'm filled up with love, so that just by being there, I can be writing my book, I can be reading, I can be listening to something, but I'm sitting there with her and she's happy that I'm there. And she feels filled and I'm filled. So that's really how I kind of work around it.
I used to work in Wales, mm-hmm, and I didn't know anyone there. I knew only the people I was working with. And the guy who was sort of my best friend there, he'd go home every weekend And I kind of didn't understand why he wouldn't invite me. And I thought it might be because I was American and he wasn't like there was a bit of a thing there. And I finally I kind of confronted him and I said, look, what, you know, are you embarrassed about me? Like, you know, why, you know, I'm stuck in this little crappy little motel in the middle of nowhere, you know, what? And he got really apologetic and sheepish and he said, no, it's not you. It's my mom's cooking. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you can taste the hate.
Wow.
And that's what I just thought of when you were talking about that. It's like you can feel where it comes from.
Yeah.
Even if it's theoretically good food, even if it's theoretically an act of service, you can taste the love or you can taste the hate.
And that is so true, because I'm a big advocate for, you know, when you're cooking, to do it from a place of love, because you're putting your energy into the food. I always put music on when I'm cooking. I love doing that. I love cooking, and I always have music on. But I truly, it's for me, it's not even a belief, but it's a knowing that we all share energy. We do. We all just share the same energy. Yeah. It's a fact. So, for you say it's not as clean. I mean, I would like to know more from your perspective how you see love and hate. And do you see them as opposites?
Well, love and hate or love and fear?
Fear. So, how do you see love and fear?
I see it a little differently in the sense it does seem to me that love is the default. Like, but for my ideas about how things should be other than the way that they are, I'm in love. Right? But for my ideas about what's wrong with me, what's wrong with other people, what's wrong with the world, I notice that the feeling that I'm left in, you could call it peace, but love works. You know, it's a nice feeling. To me, it's the feeling of being.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
But for me, one of the reasons I think it struck me is because I've never thought of fear particularly as the opposite of it, so much as one of the many other feelings that can sit on top of it. So like my journey with fear, as somebody who was terrified for most of their childhood, as we talked about, like it was shocking to me to wake up one day and kind of go, boy, fear's kind of irrelevant. Like it's one of the feelings I sometimes feel. But it no longer looked as significant. It used to look really like, can't do it if I'm afraid, or have to do it because I'm afraid, which was the manly version, right? But actually, I just thought, well, fear comes and goes. And if I really want to do something, I'll do it, and sometimes I'll be scared, and sometimes I won't. If I don't really want to do something, fear is as good a reason to not do it as any.
Yeah.
But like, I remember actually the moment, we used to do phobia cures as part of the work that we did. And I was doing a seminar with my friend. We had about 500-600 people in the audience. And we were doing public speaking phobias. And so the first person, we brought somebody up in front of the room, you know, they couldn't even look at the audience. So, you know, where's your fear on a scale from 1 to 10? 10! Right? And my friend worked with him and it did beautiful, beautiful coaching and work with him and got him down to about a 3. Wow. And I was ready to stand up and applaud and wow, that's amazing, because the guy could kind of stand there and look at the audience. And my friend went, not good enough. And wanted to get him down to a 0 and spent another hour. Now, he did get him to the point where the guy literally was fine. But I remember thinking, now that's really interesting, because I'm quite happy to be at a 3 from time to time. I don't need to not feel fear.
Exactly. So I agree with you that fear is a biological response in many cases, and it's not a bad thing. But what happened with me with having experienced going in the other realm, what I realized was that up until that point, my biggest fear had been shame. And what I mean by that is I was always afraid of disappointing people, afraid of letting people down, afraid of not being who they expected me to be. That was my biggest fear. And that was the fear that prevented me from being all that I could be or doing everything I wanted to do or fulfilling my dreams. But that is also the fear that allowed people to manipulate me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because as long as you're afraid of disappointing people, they have a hold on you. You'll always dance for the skeptics. You'll always dance for the people who don't approve of you. And when my dad said to me, go and live your life fearlessly, he didn't necessarily mean go paragliding or bungee jumping, if that's not my thing. He meant go be yourself fearlessly.
Yeah.
That's what he meant. So for me, the fear, probably if I had to narrow it down, it refers to that, the fear of being myself, the fear of disappointing people, the fear of letting people down.
I have a periodically shocking experience, to me, I don't think it would be to anyone else, where I'll feel different. I'll feel a little bit unusual. It's not unpleasant at all, but I'll just notice it. I'm in a situation that used to be scary for me, and I don't quite feel myself. And I came to realize, oh, that's what it feels like when I'm not afraid.
Yeah.
Like, I'm more familiar with being afraid than not being afraid. So it feels a little odd.
Yeah.
And it's only as I've started to see that I kind of gone, oh, this is cool. I like this not being afraid thing. Now, sometimes I'm terrified. But more and more of the time, I'm just not.
Yeah.
And that's just a bonus. It's like I've been fine with fear for a long time. It's like it's, you know, I don't know if you and I have talked about, because we both travel the world, like if I've talked about my jet lag strategy.
You may have, but go right.
So here's my jet lag strategy. Be tired. No, this has served me for years.
Yeah.
Right? And so sort of that was my fear strategy. It's like, well, be scared.
Yeah, be scared.
Right? But I didn't realize that you don't have to be. That you won't always be. So I kind of had gone so far the other way. I'd rebelled against the, you've got to have no fear.
Yeah.
To, hey, sometimes I'm scared. But I've begun to kind of see, oh, wait, actually, fearless is an option.
Yes,
not a choice, but an option, a possibility.
I like that.
And so living fearlessly, when it happens, I'm not even saying when I can do it, because I don't think I've got much to do with it. But the more I see about how thought works, the more I see about what it is to have this incredible God energy, life energy, love energy in us and running through us, I just notice myself fearless more of the time. And it's really nice.
It is, isn't it? It really is. I know, because I lived with that fear energy my entire life. My entire life, and even through cancer, it was always the fear of displeasing people, the fear of disappointing people, the fear of not fitting in, of not belonging. And that led to constantly trying to be something I'm not and trying to give and give of myself, which led to getting cancer and then the fear of the cancer and the fear of death. When I actually did die, that was the first thing I noticed, the peace, the fear was gone. It was just gone. And that is the one thing that I noticed that didn't come back after I came back. Because once you've lost the fear of death, what else is there to fear? Which reminds me of a funny story that I want to share with you.
Of course it does. What else would dying remind you of? Please tell me more.
So the first time that Wayne Dyer invited me to be on stage with him, like Hay House flew me from Hong Kong. So I was living in Hong Kong, and Hay House flew me from Hong Kong to Pasadena in 2012. And it was an I Can Do It Hay House event. And so the way he does it is they flew Danny and myself, and they had us sitting in the front row in the corner over there, and he's on stage, and he's sharing my story, and he's not telling the audience that I'm there. There's 3,000 people in the audience. Now, bear in mind, I have never done this before in my life. Like, Wayne Dyer has discovered my story on the internet. He's told Hay House to fly me there. I don't know what's coming next, right? So I'm sitting there and he's telling the audience my story, and he's saying, there's this woman in Hong Kong and she had cancer and the tumors were growing and this, and he tells the whole story, and then he goes, and then she went into this coma and her family were all praying for her and the doctors said this was it and her organs are shutting down. But anyway, She came back, but I've done one better for you. I've invited her here to share her own story. So the audience gasps, and he goes, Anita, come up on stage. So I'm like going up on stage and shaking because I have never spoken on stage before. There is an audience of 3,000 people, and it's like two levels. You've got all the people up there and all around, and I was shaking, and he goes, Anita, share your story. Tell them what happened when you were in the coma on the other side. And I was quivering, and he said, what, are you scared? And I said, yes, I'm scared. I've never spoken in front of a live audience before. And he goes, what have you got to be scared about? You've been dead and back.
He makes a good point.
He does. So I actually said, being dead is easier than public speaking.
There's an old Jerry Seinfeld routine where he talks about this stat which came from the New York Times poll about that more people have a fear of public speaking than a fear of death.
Which
he says means that at any given funeral, people would rather be than in the casket than giving the eulogy.
Yes. So yeah, that was my first introduction. He threw me in the deep end and
nice.
Yeah.
Well, can we go the other side of it? Because one of the things that, and I remember you and I have talked about this before, but you talk about loving yourself.
Yeah.
Now, as a well brought up scientific man, that just sounds icky. Right? But I know when you talk about it, it's not icky. Like I don't get that vibe. Well, you just need to love yourself, you know, you just need to right. Like I don't get that when you talk about it. So can you talk about, like, for you, what is it? This is a terrible question. What is it to love yourself in a non-icky way?
That's a great question. It's a great way of putting it. It means to realize that you are an expression of God. You are an expression of the universe. And to not honor that, to not recognize that, means to deny God from expressing himself, herself, itself through you. When you don't value yourself, when you don't see yourself as worthy, when you don't allow yourself to receive, you literally are blocking yourself from being who you came here to be. You are depriving the world from experiencing you. You're depriving the world of who you came here to be. And if you think in terms of the tapestry that I spoke about, that thread in the tapestry, that thread needs to express itself to touch all the other threads, who will then go on to touch all the other threads. You're depriving that thread from doing that. You're depriving the tapestry from being complete. You are part of a complete tapestry. So to reverse engineer that, when I was growing up, I was taught that it was selfish to love myself. And I was also taught that we have to suppress our egos. Every time my parents would take me to see spiritual gurus, which used to happen pretty often, the theme was pretty common that you have to worship somebody, something, somebody, even if it was a guru or a being outside. You had to worship someone outside of you, so you give your power away to someone outside of you, and you have to diminish your own ego. To me, diminishing my own ego was the same as diminishing my light. Every time my voice would come up that I want to say something, I would remind myself, that's my ego. I have to squash my ego. I have to suppress my ego. I dimmed my light so much that I became invisible. And that's not who we're here to become. In my culture, as a woman, we are actually rewarded for being invisible. And it took death, not even cancer. I can't be that enlightened, because even cancer wasn't a wake-up call. I literally had to die, which means I can't be that enlightened or that smart. I had to die to figure out that that's not why we came here.
Well, I'm feeling better about myself.
And we come here really to shine our light, to be full expressions of ourselves, not to diminish. And that's what it means to me, to love yourself.
There's something beautiful in that. There's I used to hate the notion of humility, right? Because it was so tied in with shame.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you need to be more humble. Oh God, I'm sorry. Right. And yes. and it always felt to me like what people were really saying is, so I can be greater.
Yes.
You need to be more humble so I can. And I kind of had a whole thing about it. And then I probably my favorite, one of my favorite things I ever heard Sid Banks say was when he said, humility isn't thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less.
I like that. See, that's good.
And that was the first time where I went, oh yeah, I don't have to be the most important person in the universe, for better or for worse. And I like that because then it's not that I'm suppressing myself or beating myself up or anything like that. I just am more available to God. I'm more available to this life force. There's a little less me in the way. Now, there's still plenty of me there.
Yeah.
Right? But like a little bit of me goes a long way. Like I always think of our egos as like the seasoning.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like Anita flavored God and Michael flavored God.
Yeah.
Now, if you put too much Anita on it, it's a little off. Some people will still like it, but it's not quite the same flavor. But a little bit of Anita will bring something out in the God souffle.
Yeah.
That isn't there otherwise. A little bit of Michael. And it'll be there anyways, because we can never really not be there. That brings something unique out in the flavor. And there'll always be people who love Anita-flavored God. There'll be people who love Michael-flavored God. There'll be people who love, you know, you-flavored God, Kelly-flavored God, Liat-flavored God, Pramila-flavored, right? It's fine. It's really good.
Yeah.
But it's just that you don't need quite as much of it as I think we sometimes put in.
I agree with you. And I feel that way about ego, in that when you tell somebody, just like you said, if somebody says to you, don't be so, like you've got to have more humility. The same way if somebody says, don't be so egotistical. In actuality, people who appear to be egotistical actually have very small egos. People who are fully confident, who know who they are, don't need to be egotistical. They don't need to constantly be the center of attention. So when you are sure of yourself, when you love yourself, you don't need to put yourself in every front and center of every situation.
You know, back when I used to do a voiceover, so mm-hmm. I was a professional voiceover.
That's why you have such a wonderful voice.
No, that's why I was a professional voiceover. It worked the other way around, but I get what you mean. But there was a guy in England at the time named Bill Bailey, and he used to be the voice of the Odeon, and he had one of these voices I dreamt of. Apparently, I just never drank enough whiskey or smoked enough cigars to have his voice. But he was this larger-than-life character. He dressed all in black. He was about 300 pounds. He always had a big black 10-gallon hat and just was this larger-than-life character. And he kind of took me under his wing because we'd run into, I was usually the light voice and he was the heavy voice. And so we did some work together. And I remember him saying something to me one day that really impacted me. And he said, Michael, I won't do the voice because I can't. he said, in this world, you must get rid of all vanity, but never let them take your ego. And oh my God, that made a difference to me. Because I suddenly saw that they were two different things. Vanity, for me, was about wanting people to see me a certain way.
Yeah.
It was about wanting to appear a certain way. It was about wanting people to like me, But ego, what I took from that in that moment, was just me being me, me expressing myself.
I like that.
Me being true to myself, me living fearlessly. And there was something about just being able to distinguish those two things that made me less self-conscious about it. And because I was less self-conscious, less conscious of that self, it did something for me.
That's really beautiful. I like that a lot. And it's similar to the difference between having an ego and being egocentric.
Yeah.
Yeah, because being egocentric means no awareness of other people, but only your own. But yeah, having a healthy ego. You know, I honestly believe that the reason why we don't have as many spiritual people, we don't have any, like really spiritually aware people in leadership positions in the world, is because in spirituality, we're constantly told to suppress our egos. But you need an ego if you want to hold a leadership position. You really do. So I really think that we really need to change this. We need to change the dialogue around egos so that people with more spiritual awareness will step up and take leadership positions.
Okay, so I'm saying in my mind, I'm going, one last question, but it might not be our last question, but one more question. People must come to you and say, all right then, dead girl, right? How do I do it? How do we get more of the love and less of the fear? Right? What do you say?
Well, first of all, I make sure that people know that the power or the strength or the enlightenment or whatever it is they're looking for, the healing, whatever they're looking for, it has to come from within them. Because the moment you want somebody else to give it to you, you are already running counter to what it is I'm speaking about. I spent my life giving my power away to everybody else. And it doesn't mean you don't go to people for help. It doesn't mean you don't go to people as training wheels, as you say, as training wheels, and you used an analogy earlier, crutches. People can be crutches, but in the end, the healing, the awakening, the insights, they have to come from within you. They have to. And I always say that the difference between a cult leader and a spiritual teacher is a cult leader will make you feel you can't attain enlightenment without them and that you're lost without them. A spiritual teacher, a true spiritual teacher, will set you free. Will set you free from needing anybody and will make you realize that you already are everything you've been trying to attain.
One of my favorite stories, it was a teacher named Nathaniel Brandon. He wrote a lot of books about the psychology of self-esteem. And he was giving a talk to a group of women on sort of self-empowerment, and his theme was no one is coming. No one's coming to rescue you. No one's coming on a white horse. No one's coming. You need to find it in you. And one of the women in the program said, but Nathaniel, you came.
Yeah.
And he said, well, yeah, but I only came to tell you that no one is coming.
That's it. I love that. That's it.